San Francisco Bay Area. It's time for Live from the Bay with Joey. Here's Joey.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Live from the Bay with Joey. We've got a really special show tonight. Starting a series on the Spanish journey, and this actually has a lot to do with those Spanish people that actually immigrated to the Hawaiian Islands and later to California. So make sure that you tell some of your Spanish friends or people that you may know that are Spanish, whose families immigrated to Hawaii, that they definitely don't want to miss this show, and they may want to pass it on to other family members. So I want to talk to you a little bit about what we're going to be presenting to you tonight and a little bit of the background. In the early 1900s, the Spanish, those that were primarily from the south of Spain, were given an opportunity by the English to pack their bags along with their families and leave their struggling Spain and search for a better life in the Americas via Hawaii and to work on the sugar plantations with the Portuguese. These various journeys went on for a few years, from Spain to Hawaii, and thousands actually departed. The promise, a new home, a better life, and the promise of land that actually did not happen. Their trips would not be easy ones, for they would have to withstand a nearly 60-day trip, terrible ship, living conditions and treatment, horrible sanitary conditions, and watching the death of their children and other family members on this journey. When they did arrive to Hawaii, the life that was promised was not necessarily what they had pictured. They endured, fought the good fight, lived for a while in the Hawaiian paradise, and later many would move on to California to follow their families. This is only where the story begins. All of the people that are represented here today on the show, including myself, are those children, grandchildren, descendants of Spaniards that immigrated from Spain to Hawaii, except for one whose family immigrated to another part of the United States. All of us have in common that we are Spanish Americans, proud to be Americans, but equally proud of our Spanish ancestry, our heritage, and our culture. Today, my friends, we want to take you on a journey from Spain to the United States, primarily to Hawaii and then on to California. And this is the first part of our stories. Joining me will be authors Gloria Lopez of An American Paella, as well as Patricia Ruiz Steele, author of The Girl Immigrant, as well as Michael Munoz, that put together the Hawaiian Spaniard Facebook page, and James Fernandez, who also has been the webmaster of Spaniards in the USA on Facebook, and currently putting together some documentaries and biographical sketches on the Spanish immigration here to the United States. So my first guest, without further ado, hails from California as well, and his name is Mike Munoz. And let's see if Mike is there with us right now. Hold on, Mike, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great. Thank you for joining us here on Live from the Bay with Joey. I'm interested in finding out a little bit about how the idea came up. You came up with the idea of the Hawaiian Spaniard page on Facebook, and then a little bit about your family and your background and how this all came to fruition.
Well, I began collecting my family's genealogy in about 1980, and while I was doing that, I began collecting photographs and sitting with my grandmother and writing the names of the people in the photographs. So that was about, I don't know, 30 years ago, 80. And it just became a real hobby for me, genealogy. Then I got involved with Facebook, and through a friend of mine, Larry Campos in Winters, I met Professor James Fernandes, who had the Spanish Immigrants in the United States Facebook page. And my Facebook page hadn't taken off until I met James. And a year or two ago, we've gone from 2 members, my sister and I, to 1,000. And we have people from all over the United States and Europe and Argentina and Chile and even Czechoslovakia who are immigrants or children of immigrants who left Spain about 1910.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. That's pretty awesome to go from like 2 members all the way up to 1,000. So
yeah.
I mean, I was really blown away when I saw it because I thought, wow, thank God we've got some people that are, that we've got a group of people that are saying, this is part of our past, it's part of our history. We want to honor those. And in doing so, what better way than to do it on Facebook? Because Facebook really does open up just a world of possibilities, right?
Right,
I mean, things that you would have never known. I mean, like you and I, right? Here, I reached out to you, I contacted you, and then I thought to myself, we have Munoz in our family too, although I don't think it's the same relation. But, and I was talking to you about the show that I was going to be doing with Ancestry.com and bringing them on, and then you said, oh, yeah, I got involved. And then we both go on to Ancestry.com and it's showing that there's a possibility that we may be distantly related,
Right. Well, that's happened to a number of people on the Hawaiian Spaniards page.
Is that right?
My good friend Joe Galvin, we've been friends for years and years. Turns out his first cousin took the test, and I'm related to him distantly. They're from southern Spain, from Andalusia and Malaga.
Right.
And I just thought that was the greatest thing that could happen, that I'm actually related to a good friend of mine.
Oh, that is very cool. Now, where did your family come from? What area of southern Spain?
All my grandparents were from Spain. My great-grandparents were all from Spain, and they immigrated to three grandparents immigrated to Hawaii from they left on the Williston and on the Orteric.
Mm-hmm.
And then my one grandfather immigrated to Cuba, then to New York, mm-hmm. and then traveled across the United States to get to Oakland.
Wow.
And they were Rose Campos, Joe Campos, Rosalia Sanchez, Cayetano mm-hmm. Serrana, and Isabel Corrales were my grandparents.
Well, that's great. So what town were they from?
Well, they were from Jerez, San uh-huh. Roque, Ubida,
uh-huh.
Horcajo de Montemayor, which is near Salamanca, which is
uh-huh.
not in southern Spain. It's in the middle of Spain.
Right. Wow, that's awesome.
But conditions in Spain were so poor that some of my family were immigrating to Hawaii, and others were immigrating to South America and Argentina and coming back to Spain and buying property.
Right.
It's very interesting.
I've heard about, I think in northern Spain, they call them, not indios, but they call them indianos or something, which means that they were people that they hailed from Spain, they went to Latin America, and then they came back to Spain. And really interesting. I mean, my family, though, once they left, they never did return. Although my great-grandfather did remain there. But anyway, if somebody, say somebody's listening and they're interested in your website, the name of your website on Facebook again is Hawaiian
Spaniards.
Uh-huh. Spaniards.
With an
Hawaiian
F.
Spaniards. Okay.
Yeah.
Hawaiian Spaniards. So, folks, you know what his website is. So now make sure you get on there and become a part of it, and I think it's really great information. What I've really enjoyed seeing is many pictures and stories, and finding out about different, like certain people that I've heard of over the years and what happened to them. And through your website, I was able to gain more information. So I want to thank you, Mike, for that. And I know you're going to stay with us here because we're going to be bringing you back to join us for some more information. You'll get some more information on what Mike does during his pastime, et cetera, et cetera. And then without further ado, now I have with me Patricia Ruiz Steele, and she's the author of a book called The Girl Immigrant. So, Patricia, are you with us, sir?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes. Hi, Patricia. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. So I'd like to know a little bit about how you got interested in writing this book, The Girl Immigrant, maybe a little bit about your family and then how this opened up doors for you in research, et cetera, because I think that's really interesting. I think people find it fascinating.
Well, when I first started to be interested in my Spanish culture, it was because I had not lived with a Spanish family because my parents divorced when I was about 9. So I really was very interested in being part of the Spanish culture, but I didn't really know how to do it. And as I grew up, we visited every year because we'd moved to Oregon by then. So I was very close to my abuelita, but I only saw her once a year, and my father sometimes once a year. And I had a lot of names in my head that I knew were relatives from somewhere. And years went by before I finally decided that I was writing books, but I decided I wanted to write a book about abuelita and her history, and I didn't know anything except for a few names. I knew she came from Spain. I knew she went to Hawaii. I didn't know how she got there or why they left. And so I took a genealogy class, and I wanted to be part of that part of my life that I didn't have ever touched me. So once I learned that there were lists of ships and her name might be on one of them, I started really studying hard and learning where to begin, because I didn't know, and I was also looking at that time to find a book or two that explained the factual Spanish immigration story. And I even went as far as the Library of Congress, and there was nothing but a little tiny missive from a man who'd written about his family, and I just couldn't believe that there was nothing out there. So I didn't know where to begin, so I decided to ship. And I joined Ancestry.com, and I started talking to family members, and I had all these notes from over the years of all these names, and I didn't know if I'd ever be able to get to Spain, but I just really started delving into the family, and all of a sudden, one fact fell onto the other until I started amassing all these documents and photographs like Mike explained that he did years ago. And I was getting so thrilled that I became addicted to genealogy and decided that I would write the book through my grandma's eyes. She left when she was 9 years old, and they came with, there were 9 children and 7 adults from Fuente Sauco, which is just above Salamanca. And they took the train until their money ran out, and they got to Sevilla, got on a boat, went all the way to La Línea, and they went to the river, and then they walked for 12 days until they got to Gibraltar at La Línea and took the Orteric. And I followed them all the way just to Hawaii, and my grandfather was actually from the Malaga area, and they were in the Spanish ethnic community on the Hawaiian Islands in the sugar plantations, and they met young and met again in California, and here I am. So I was able to touch Spanish soil for the first time in 2012, and I went through all the villages, mm-hmm. and it was just like a piece of me finally became whole, and I was mm-hmm. able to write The Girl Immigrant, and it was just a wonderful journey. And so now there is a story that people can read, that they can feel connected to, that it's not just names and places and dates. It's a real story.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's pretty awesome. Yeah, I think it's so important for Spanish people and Spanish Americans to have that piece of their history because, you know, you have a lot of other ethnic groups that do have it. The Greeks have it, the Italians have it, the Portuguese have it, you know, and the Mexicans have it. A lot of different groups, the Filipinos have it. And somehow the Spanish people have not been as vocal about their heritage until really recently, where there's always been Spanish clubs, etc. But, you know, quite honestly, your book, along with Gloria Lopez's book, really, I think, are real important here because I believe that they're going to pave the way for things, more things that we're going to see in the future. So, you know, how fascinating is that? I've always liked genealogy. I've always been actively involved in that and tracing and information on DNA, et cetera, et cetera. Boy, I'll tell you, I don't want to steal your thunder, and I want people to go and get a hold of your book. Can you let people know how they can obtain a copy of The Girl Immigrant?
Well, it is available on my website, which is www.patriciabbsteele.com. And it is also available through Amazon, and it can be ordered directly at Barnes & Noble.
Okay.
So those three venues, the signed copies from my website or the other two media.
And I think, again, Patricia, it's really imperative and important for us to give it your website again, because it's not just patriciasteele.com. It is patriciabbsteele.com. I'm wondering where you got that BB from.
Well, at the time that I created my website, I found out that patriciasteele.com was taken, but it was inactive, so I asked the woman who had the website if I could use her website. She says, you sure can, for about $5,000, and I thought, I needed to be creative. So growing up, I was always called Betty Boop, and so I decided that I would change it just a little bit. So it's Patricia BB Steele with an E.com. So the BB is for Betty Boop.
Well, I'm not going to be calling you Betty Boop anytime in the future, but
thank you very much.
But I think that's just a real nice story that brings a smile to my face. You know, there's going to be people out there, Patricia, that are interested in tracing their family background. And in the few moments that we have left here, can you tell them, is it really something really terribly difficult to do? Where do you really start? I mean, say, for instance, you know, there's going to be people out there that they know that their grandparents or their great-grandparents were from Spain, but they don't know anything outside of that. And I'm going to tell you, that recently happened to me in connecting with my grandfather's brother's family outside of the Sacramento area. One of the great-grandkids said, had we not connected with you, you're the missing piece, and had we not connected with you, we probably wouldn't have had all the information we have now. It was like a missing link, you know? Mm-hmm. But where do people really start to get this information?
Well, I believe that the first thing that I could suggest would be the ship manifest, because that has a wealth of information. And right now those manifests are being transcribed so that everybody can find out if they know even part of their family names. What you learn on these ships' lists are their name, how old they were, if they could read or write, what their family name was, where their village was that they left, and wonderfully also is listed is the name of the person that they left behind. Now, when I first started and I found that first ship manifest, I couldn't sleep all night because not only was I excited about finding it, but what I realized is they listed my great-grandmother, my great-great-grandmother. I found out she was still alive when they left, and I had no idea. So it dawned on me when I saw that manifest that this woman saw four of her adult children and nine of her grandchildren walk away, and she never saw them again. So those are the kind of things that helped me go back. I found out where their family was, where they came from. I found out what the family names were before that, and I found a genealogist there that helped me find the two villages that they were from based on the baptismal documents that I found, because those baptismal documents also list their name, their full names, where they were married, where they came from, where they, you know, who their godparents were, so much information, and that's what led mm-hmm. me all the way back to find eight siblings that no one had ever heard of.
Mm-hmm. You know, what you just said was really important here, you know, and it's in when you're painting that picture, I mean, a lot of us, I know when you mentioned this about, you know, your great-grandmother, you know, not being able to see her family again once they left. This story probably has been repeated over and over and over and over again through all the people that immigrated to Hawaii, to America. How many of those people had to say goodbye to their parents, to their grandparents, and fully knowing that they were never, ever going to see them again? How painful that must have been, you know, when you think about it. Just
too heartbreaking.
Right? And I know that
very
your
heartbreaking, yeah.
Yeah, I know that your story is filled with a lot of joy. I know that there's probably some heartbreaking stories in here as well. But I am so glad that you were able to join us and participate. And thank you for your work that you have done. And I believe it's going to be a continuum. It's going to be a series. Is that correct?
Yes,
this
it is
book,
a series.
It's going to be,
the first book is the story, and the second and third books are the actual biographical, historical books of each family.
Well, that's awesome.
You know, in each chapter.
Okay. Well, Patricia, thanks again for joining us, and we're going to have you join us back later on in the show. But thanks again for joining us on Live from the Bay with Joey for this real special segment, folks, really the Spanish journey. And, you know, these segments, these first couple of segments that we're going to have, is really going to be focusing on those immigrants, those people that left Spain to the Hawaiian Islands. All of us that are represented here today, pretty much all of us, our families did immigrate to Hawaii, or a portion of our families did, to the Hawaiian Islands from Spain. So this is very real, and I know a lot of people out there don't quite understand maybe what we're talking about. You hear Hawaiian Spaniards, you're thinking, what are these, like, Spaniards that were mixed with Hawaiians? Are they Hawaiians that were, you know, it kind of leads you, you're not sure what it really means. Well, we're trying to tell you what this means is there was a story about a people that were once in the Iberian Peninsula not that long ago. And what happened? To turn of the 20th century, they came over, and then what happened? They went over to the Hawaiian Islands. They immigrated to Hawaii. And that's why all of us are here today, believe it or not. And there's thousands of us. So joining me next is the author of An American Paella, also hailing from Winters, California. I love the name of that. And you know what else I love about this town of Winters is that there's a whole lot of people just like us there. So that's very cool as well. So without further ado, here with me is Gloria Lopez. Gloria, are you there?
I am here.
How are you?
How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks
good.
For joining us. And so, you know, tell us a little bit about this project. Tell us a little bit about your family and that dynamic, because there's a lot going on there. And this book, as well as your CD, was really a wonderful, just a wonderful project. I mean, it was just, it left me on the edge of my seat. I think both yourself as well as Patricia Steele's book, you know, it's really important for those people that are, like I said before, that are of Spanish ancestry, to get a copy of these and to put it, you know, on their coffee tables, to share it with their friends, to share it with their family members, because this is really part of who we are. And quite honestly, I don't know of too many books out there like this. So tell us a little bit about how this came to fruition, a little bit about your family as well. So.
All righty. Well, I grew up in a very small town in Northern California, Winters, California. And in this town, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of us that are descendants from Spain. And so I grew up with Spaniards, and that's my background on both sides. And so my grandparents on my father's, or excuse me, on my mother's side, came through Hawaii, and so they came on the very first ship in April of 1907, the Heliopolis, and they left Spain, as all the other families did, because they were very poor. They were peasants. The economic conditions were so bad in Spain, and there was a poster that everyone has seen a copy of that promised them this wonderful life in Hawaii. They promised them jobs for their families and a home and a small acreage, and all they had to do was hop on the boat and go over to Hawaii. So my mother's family, my grandparents were children, so they came with my great-grandparents, and they went to Hawaii, and they stayed only 11 months. They left in 1908. They did not fulfill their contract because it was kind of an empty promise for them. It wasn't better for them. And so they made their way over to San Francisco, as did most of the Spaniards that left Spain and went to Hawaii. And they worked in San Francisco with a number of other families, and they worked in the factories, candy factories, followed up and down the state of California, the fruit harvest. They were in Monterey working in the sardine factories. And then many of them ended up in this Winters Vacaville area. And if anyone ever comes here, you'll see why, because it looks just like southern Spain, the hills right outside of town. And so they started gathering here, as immigrants do. They gather together. And so that's what I grew up with. My father's parents came a little bit later in 1920, but the Hawaiian Spaniards that came to Winters started coming here in about 1910. And over the years, as three waves of immigrants came, the first from Hawaii, the second through the East Coast, the next one came before and after the Civil War. You know, there are just so many of us here. And so I grew up immersed in the Spanish culture. And, you know, the language was spoken, the foods were eaten, the traditions. And as I got older, after I had my children, and as my grandparents passed away and my parents were aging, I thought, all of these stories, these traditions, they need to be saved. You know, we need to tell these stories. I want my kids, my grandkids, to understand how we got here and how much we've accomplished. And mm-hmm. so I started this project. I waited for someone else to do it, and no one did. And so I just thought, well, I know everyone.
Right.
And I don't want it just to be about my family. I wanted it to be from many voices. And
mm-hmm.
so I just did about 80-plus interviews, and I had a videographer. We recorded them all, and so we put them into a book and into a documentary, and I wanted it to be a keepsake. You know, I wanted the book to be something that people would put on their coffee table and be proud of their heritage and their history. And so that's what I did with my project.
Wow, that is awesome. And, yeah, I mean, obviously this book does deserve that type of, you know, that type of placement. You know, I can see it easily on a coffee table. And the video or the CD that went, I guess it's separate, but basically has a lot of the testimonials and some of the history. That was some powerful stuff. You know, I was watching it. Oh, probably, I don't know, maybe there was 3 or 4 times I had to make sure nobody was close to me to see me get choked up, you know.
Yeah.
And I was like, doggone it, you know, because what it does is it reminds you so much of what you've been raised with. It reminds you of your family members that are no longer with you and their stories, because they all shared the same thing. I know my mom was telling me as a kid when her parents became naturalized, my mom was telling me that that so many days after school, she would sit there and she would quiz my grandparents, you know.
Exactly. I had that same experience.
Yeah. And so, you know, I heard the story, and then I thought, okay, you know, that's cool. Well, then I watched this video, and there was a couple people, or at least one that I remember, that was talking about the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, my God, it was just like a repeat. And then there were other people on there that I thought to myself, I looked at them, and I said, you know, I know these people. I know that I know these people. They look too familiar. And maybe I did. Maybe my family did. I mean, I know that one of my grandmother's brothers worked in Winters during the summers, et cetera.
Wow.
And so we know that there were associations. You know, my grandparents went from Hawaii over to San Francisco, and my mom was raised in Visitation Valley, San Francisco. But again, you know, there were those Spanish people that either ended up, like you said, in San Francisco. Some ended up in the East Bay. There were some that ended up in the Sacramento Valley. Some, I guess your area is considered, is that considered, what is that considered? Winters, is that considered
Winters,
the Sacramento Valley?
Winters, Vacaville area?
Yeah,
yeah,
but is that considered Sacramento Valley?
I think so,
right.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And then
we're
I have
the
family
west side.
Yeah. And then, you know, I have family from my grandfather's side in the Rockland area. And that, again,
mm-hmm.
is a big Spanish community. Probably not as big as Winters, because Winters seems to have quite a few.
Well, I think we're more prevalent here because it's a small town. So the
uh-huh.
concentration of the Spaniards here. And also, this is a very agricultural town. And the majority of families, not all of them, but the majority of the families became involved in agriculture because that's what they knew. And so
mm-hmm.
they started out as laborers. And, you know, there are all these stories about them. The Depression hit. And, you know, none of the banks would ever give Spanish immigrants accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And so they all pulled their money as families. They had cash. The Depression hit. People lost
mm-hmm.
their land, and here were the Spaniards with cash. They started
mm-hmm.
accumulating 20 acres, 80
mm-hmm.
acres, and so they became landowners and farmers. So it was quite a transition for them, you know, through
mm-hmm.
the just like 2 generations that took.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I've got a question for you. When you, let's go back to your book, because I have, I don't want to change directions here, but I want to go back to this book. When you were coming up with this book and you heard the stories, and, you know, and I mean, there's so many things to pick from, and which, you know, I mean, you want to include everybody, but maybe perhaps you can include everybody. But was there anything that really stood out to you that just made you stand back and just go, wow, just have like a moment that you were just like blown away, just said, you know, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think it was something I always knew, but to hear it over and over again, just the work ethic. I mean, we were just such hard workers, and over again, you know, hearing about everyone's abuelita who, you know, worked all day but somehow had food on the table, you know, at lunch, big meals, and just,
right.
You know, and the work, you know, my working title of the project was, you know, stories of hard work, strong families, and good food. And that
right.
really came through in so many of the stories that I heard.
You know, interestingly, when you think of southern Spain because of the heat, you know, and it's
mm-hmm.
so hot, and people taking siestas, the rest of Spain always has in their mind that the Andalusians are lazy. You know, they just like to siesta all day long, play their guitar, sing, you know, flamenco and eat, and, you know, they have no cares in the world. But what's interesting is they come over here, and the work ethic was so much a focus.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, I don't think I've heard it in any other group of people as much as I've heard it with Spanish people. I mean, they did put a heavy emphasis on that. I mean, I always heard that as well growing up, you know. This one worked hard. Nobody worked harder than me. I worked so many. Oh, well, but I worked, you know. It's
yeah,
funny.
It was like that. You're working. Oh, everything's good then. Everybody's working.
Yeah, exactly. So, but if you're not working, it's not good, you know.
Yeah.
So, but it's really interesting. You know, what is your take now on the younger generation of people that, especially in winters, because you can attest to that, people living there, but the younger generation, maybe those that are teenagers and in their 20s, do they want to retain this? Do you think they want to still retain this part of who they are? Is there a strong interest still?
In some cases, yes, because of some of the foods. And so some of them are still interested in participating in making chorizo or some of the other, you know, food traditions we have. But on the other hand, you know, we're going on, you know, third, fourth, maybe even fifth generations. And as with all immigrant groups that come to the United States, you know, you become assimilated into the dominant culture, so you start to lose, you start to lose some of that identity, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to make sure to get these stories down so that, you know, perhaps we can retain some of our identity. But understand that, you know, we're all proud Americans, and most of the Spanish immigrants did become naturalized citizens and believed in education, and, you know, we're hard workers. But through the generations, you know, you start to lose that because kids want to fit in. And certainly my parents had a harder time fitting in as mm-hmm. the first generation born here. Mm-hmm. I had a little bit easier, still faced, you know, some barriers and problems. Mm-hmm. And I don't think my kids faced any. So, mm-hmm. you know, but that's the process.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit. You and I will talk a little bit more about that. Save that comment because I want to come back and kind of retouch on that comment about, you know, over the years, generations start losing, because I think that's really something important. I want to talk to James about it, too, because you'll notice in certain communities, like, say, your Greek community, the Italian community, the Portuguese community, the Mexican community, even second, third, fourth, fifth generation still retain their culture. Why is that? Is that because of the possibility that they're still linked, they have heavy ties to the church? And I don't know. I can only attest to my family, but a lot of them broke from the Roman Catholic Church. So mm-hmm. I would say, you know, only about 10% of my family remained Roman Catholic. And the Roman Catholic churches that they went to were not necessarily primarily Spanish-speaking. So that's mm-hmm. something that I want to delve into a little bit more. And maybe James can help me out there. But let people know, if they want to get a copy of An American Paella, they want to get a copy of that American Paella but DVD form, let them know your website. Let them know how they can do that. Because, again, this show will be going out to many people who know people. They have a friend that might be Spanish. Their grandparents came from Spain to the Hawaiian Islands. They're part of a Spanish club that never, ever heard that both of these books, Patricia's book nor your book, have been out there. They want to get a hold of An American Paella. Let them know how they can do that.
Sure. I just want to say that it is not a cookbook. An American Paella refers to, you know, it's a metaphor of understanding everything that went into becoming American but staying Spanish. And so you can get the book and or the DVD at anamericanpaella.com or amazon.com. Or I'm on Facebook. Just message me, and you can go through me directly. You usually get a deal that way.
Wonderful. Okay, I'm going to put you on hold here. I'm going to have you join me in a couple of minutes here. But, folks, I just want to let you know, too, that, you know, this show will go into an archive, so you can hear it anytime you want, and you can let people know about it. So that's really a nice thing. It's not going to go away. You know, we've heard about all these people and their backgrounds and how their families immigrated here. And I don't have anybody interviewing me, so I'm just going to tell you a little bit about who I am so you know. Actually, you can, if you don't know already who I am, you can Google my name, Joey Vilches Nardone, or Nardone, and you will get all the information you want. But I am a singer, songwriter, have been for a few years, have many works out there, been published, had my first recording out of Nashville when I was pretty young. I think it was about 1984, 85. And do music in Spanish as well. One of the last tunes that I did actually won an award. It was called Sin Ti, Without You, and it is in Spanish. I've studied some flamenco voice that I incorporate some sounds, but not necessarily all sounds. Again, I've acted, been not so active as of recent, but that's part of who I am as well. And my family, too, my maternal family, came from Estepona, Malaga, Spain, over to the Hawaiian Islands in 1911 on the Williston. And so both the Aguilar side of my family, as well as the Vilches side of the family, came over during that time. My great-grandfather on the Vilches side, as well as one of the brothers, remained there in Spain. They never did come out to outside for visiting. They never came out to make their homes in the United States, California. But that's who I am, and that's part of what I've been engulfed in all my life. My grandmother was the oldest daughter. There were two daughters of the Aguilar family. So my grandmother lived with us. So she was the matriarch. So all the family, which there were eight of them, including my grandmother, would be over all the time. And I would hear stories about Hawaii, and I would hear stories about Spain. And I was engulfed in it. My aunt and uncle lived two houses away from us, and I always had family living close by. So that's who I am. And I'm going to bring Gloria back on, and then I'm going to bring Mike back on, because he actually does retain a couple of things that Spanish people hold dear still to this day. But I'm going to bring Gloria back on. What we're going to do is talk a little bit about some of those you know, some of those traditions, some of those foods that you had growing up. Now, I'm going to share a couple of things with you. Tell me if you had that. You know, Christmas time was always kind of an important time, right?
Yeah.
And you would have aunts and uncles dropping over, at least in my family, and they'd always bring membrillo, which was quince, right?
Yes.
And we seem to like Membrillo a lot. So Membrillo. And then everybody would bring their rendition of rosquetes or rosquetillos or whatever, or mantecaos, you know, as well. Those are two cookies that we primarily had during during that time frame. And every once in a while, during a holiday, we would do a paella, make a paella. But, you know, there were things that we still retained, and it was kind of old traditions, you know. I remember my grandmother being very superstitious. I don't know about your family, but my grandmother was super superstitious. Super superstitious. How about that? She was just, I mean, if there was anybody that was superstitious. And when I was a kid, do you remember that song, Eres Tú?
Yes.
You ever? And
I don't remember the words, but I remember the song.
Yeah, yeah. And that was a group from Spain. They were called Mocedades, and they came out with a song, and it was real popular. I was very young. I think I was probably in junior high or something like that, or if even. And I, at that time, and I might have been younger than junior high, but nonetheless, we had 45s, remember? And so I got that 45 of that album. My grandmother's brother had just passed away somewhere. He was like in Placerville or something. And here we were in Mountain View, California, and I had that 45, and I kept playing it and playing it. And my grandmother came in. She read me the right act. She was telling me that basically I was going to hell in a handbasket, and how could I play that 45 when her brother had passed away? And she said, you know, in Spanish she told me, you know, the dead can hear us. They can... And I was like, oh, my God. I mean, she, like, totally freaked me out, you know. So every time I ever played that 45 again of Eres Tú, you know, I don't know. I was probably looking around to make sure there were no dead people hanging out or coming after me or something, you know. But funny things that, you know, customs, right, that are passed down or stories or what can you remember?
Gosh, most of... what I can remember, I think, probably has to do with food and the different traditions that went with certain foods that you know, would make at certain times of the year and just very traditional for our families. Every Spanish family makes everything a little bit differently. We've talked about that before, whether it comes to, you know, some of the cookies or even how we make chicken and rice, you know, arroz con pollo. Every family does it a little bit differently. And certainly with my family, my mother's side of the family was from Malaga, and my father's side of the family was from Almería, and so heaven forbid, those were two different methods of cooking. So, and those we had some lively discussions about that. And then, you know, just things like we always had anisette, you know, to drink in the little tiny glasses, and the way, you know, wine was always in little juice glasses, not in, you know, fancy wine glasses. And, you know, even paella, you know, we talk about a lot about that now, but it was not really paella as we know it when I was growing up, because we didn't have money. And so my father used to always say that, you know, his mother would just put, you know, if they lived out in the country, if he had shot a jackrabbit that day, that's what went in the rice. And so, you know, they're very, our families were very peasant-style people. And, you know, so food went a long ways, and it was very, they were very frugal about their food.
Right, right. Do you know, here's one thing. You speak Spanish fluently, yeah? Pretty well?
Semi-fluently, enough to get by, certainly. My grammar I worry about.
Yeah. Well, I speak Spanish pretty fluently. And then when I was talking to some of my cousins from Spain, I was using a few words that they were like, wow, really? And I'm like, what do you mean? And they're like, those words have not been used for a long time.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, what are we talking about a long time? And they're like, almost 100 years.
Yes, because we're in
and
a
I'm
time
like,
warp.
Well, Yeah, I'm like, well, I'm not 100 years old, you know, by no means. But there's mm-hmm. certain words that they don't use as much, you know, as they once did. Or it's something that makes them laugh, you know.
Well, James really could speak to that because that's what he teaches.
Yeah, but, you know, in my family, we always use things like, I always remember, que jaleo, you know?
Yes.
And, oh, my God, that was just like, you know, so it's funny. Sometimes I'll talk to people and I'll say, eso es un jaleo. And they're like looking at me like, what are you talking about? You know, what is that? Or so it's kind of interesting. You know, I wanted to talk, you've heard me talk about this before, but, you know, food is so different in every region of Spain. And dependent on what we were taught, you know, I always thought growing up, since we were Spanish, you know, the food that my grandmother cooked was all Spanish food. Well, that's not the case. Some of it was modified or learned mm-hmm. here. And then there was also the fact that different regions of Spain cooked completely different. So
yes.
I just thought everybody, you know, cooked basically the same food. Okay, well, we know paella is, and now tapas have become very, you know, popular, the small little dishes of Spain, so we understand
mm-hmm.
that. But, boy, I mean, I've had friends from Catalonia, Spain, northern Spain, out of Barcelona.
Mm-hmm.
Their food is completely different. I've had friends that are from Galicia. Their food is completely different. I've had friends from the Canary Islands. Their food is completely different. Yet it's all Spanish food, you know?
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting. But we're so accustomed to, many times, what we were raised with. It's not always uniform, you know. It's not. There's different regions, and people make different food, and there's, you know, that's just the way it is. My family made something that we call pamplinas. I don't know where we got the word from. I have no idea. One time I heard that the word pamplina actually came from Puerto Ricans used it for bread, and then somebody else, I was talking to some Puerto Ricans, they said, no, I don't think so. I know what pamplina means in Spanish, but pamplinas that we made were similar to maybe the calzone that Italian people make, and then we would fill it with meat and olives and tomatoes and stuff, and it was baked or fried or what have you. In Galicia, they make empanadas, that are similar. There are certain people that I've talked to, and I don't know if it was you as well, that make empanadillas that fill things with some kind of sweet stuff that goes inside. We never had that. But it's interesting. I've talked to other Spaniards, and they're like, oh, yeah, those are empanadas. And what do you call them? I said, pamplinas. And they didn't know where that word came from. I don't know if it's a word that they used in Estepona, in the city, because there's certain things that, I don't know. Have you ever heard of tejeringos?
No, and I haven't heard of pamplinos either.
Okay.
those are two that I don't know how to make.
Pamplinas. But tejeringos are primarily from the Malaga and area in Estepona that are like churros.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very similar.
I know churros.
Yeah, but they don't call them churros. They call them tejeringos. So, you know, it's kind of interesting. Every area has different things. So, and you know what I liked about your book, too, is you got some recipes back there, even though it's not a recipe book, but you got some stuff back there. Which is really cool. And then, like, when I was watching the video and I saw, was it your aunt making...
Mm-hmm. Miga?
Making migas, I was like, that's totally different, you know, because the way I heard that we made them and watching my grandmother make them and stuff like that, we did it with bread, you know?
Yeah.
But every
and we make
place,
a batter.
Yeah, and you make a batter. So every place is different, and every family is different, and that's what makes the world go round. And thank you so much for joining with me and sharing. And then now I want to really bring back Mike, because I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think that Mike was telling me that he himself actually, I may not be able to bring back Mike right now. Gloria, are you there?
I am here.
You're still there.
Mm-hmm.
So my system just went down. That's terrible.
Well, I know Mike still cures olives. And,
oh, he does.
Mm-hmm. And I think he's going to attempt to cure jamon, and my family still makes jamon. We make chorizo. And Mike also makes wine. And so in California, that's always a good thing to do. And so he's back to his roots with the olives and wine, and now he's going to try jamon. And
great.
So you know, we all try to do, try to keep those traditions up. I have peppers that I grow every year from seed. When my paternal grandfather came over in 1920, he brought pepper seed from Spain. He'd plant it every year, save the seed, plant it. He did it for 50, 60 years, then my father did it, and now I do it. So the peppers that I grow, and they're, well, I just call them Spanish peppers. I really don't know what else to call them, but they're from seed that, came over with my grandparents. And so that's kind of, I'm keeper of the seed right now.
How funny. Now, do you think that they really taste that different than, like, say, bell peppers?
They have a completely different texture. They're not thick and as meaty. They are good for frying or roasting. It's a different kind of pepper.
Mm-hmm.
And I roast them on a fire, over an open fire, and I roast them and peel them and that kind of thing.
Do you make a salad out of them?
Yes,
I use
them when I make rice dishes, when I make guisados, different soups, and we have a couple of different salads we use them in.
Yeah, see, I remember my grandma, and I still do that from time to time. Although I'm pretty lazy. What I do is I go to the store and I get some fire roasted peppers,
mm-hmm.
uh-huh, and I cut them up.
Yeah.
And then we make a salad
with
out of
tomatoes
that.
And onions and cucumbers and vinegar and oil.
That's another salad that we do too. And Greeks make a salad that's very similar to that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another salad we make. But the one that I'm talking about is simply it's the pimentos that have been fire roasted that have been. Yeah, so, and then you cut those up, and those are placed in a vinaigrette type of dressing.
Mm-hmm.
And some people put some onions in it, and that's served as another type of salad, a coleslaw salad. Have you ever had anything like that?
Yes, and then we also make gazpacho, but our gazpacho is a little bit different because our families that came 100 years ago came without electricity, and so our gazpacho is unblended. It has everything that you find in gazpacho, tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, red onions, vinegar, and oil, and
mm-hmm.
We just chunk it up. We don't blend it, and actually we serve it ice cold. We put ice in it and let it sit. And,
sounds good. That sounds
yeah,
really
and
good.
Then we eat the jamon and always pan, always bread,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
That, we do that several times, during the summer, and we use those mm-hmm. Spanish peppers.
Yeah,
but those fresh peppers, not roasted.
Yeah. Now, interestingly, even though my family was from Andalusia, from Malaga area, from Estepona, the gazpacho that my grandmother made, there were a few different ones, but the gazpacho that my grandmother made was actually a different kind of gazpacho, and it was with it was made with egg and garlic mm-hmm. and lemon, and I think sometimes they put croutons on it, and some people would put grapes. So that was different,
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, there are many different kinds. There's one that's made with almonds.
Right.
And then, we make ajo, which
yeah.
is garlic and,
yeah,
you know, different.
Well,
things.
Thank you, Gloria, for joining
okay.
me in this portion. And Mike, you know, Mike has been holding there for me. And I know, Mike, we're going to bring you on real quick. I know that you, like Gloria had said, and you had told me as well, but so you've got your own, you make your own wine, huh?
Yeah, well, my grandfathers were bootleggers.
Oh, okay.
And, I've just carried on that tradition. I don't sell wine. We make it, the family makes it,
mm-hmm.
something we share amongst ourselves, and I cure olives. I pick them myself. I used to get embarrassed seeing my parents on Foothill Boulevard in Oakland, or in Hayward,
uh-huh.
picking olives.
Oh.
And now I've turned into my parents, so I'm
oh,
going to
yeah.
try to make. I made a jamon once; it didn't turn out very well, but now I think I'm set up better to try one again this year.
Yeah, thank you for the remembrance of olives. That's a big thing with us, right? I mean, everybody in my family too used to, you know, make olives, and people would bring them by, and you know, those are really great. Spanish olives are just wonderful. You know, they're just for
I'm
me
just
at
lucky.
Least. I'm sure. Yeah.
I'm just lucky to have all this heritage, and it's something I was born with.
So. Yep, yep. And I think all of us here, we're, you know, all of us share that, and that's part of who we are. And so, you know, we are all so grateful. So anyway, thanks again, Mike. Stay with us till the end here. And now I'm going to bring with us, hopefully, we're not going to get cut out here again, but all the way from the East Coast here with us, is James Fernandez. Are you there?
I'm here, Joey. Hi, how
are
you doing?
Oh, thanks for your patience. Oh, I'm doing well. How are you?
Great, really good.
Are you getting an earful?
I am learning a lot. I'm a big fan of the work of Mike and Patricia and Gloria. They're doing an amazing job preserving a heritage that really is in danger of disappearing.
Right. So tell me a little bit about what you do and what really is part of your work and the documentaries you're involved in. And then we'll have you on some other time, too, because I know that you've also traced the heritage of those Spaniards that did not necessarily come from Andalusia nor to Hawaii, but they came to other places, including those people that went to Louisiana that were from the Canary Islands, and those people from Asturias that were in West Virginia, I believe, and those people from Galicia and all that. But tell me the work that you're doing now, and then tell me how, when you were interviewing, I take it you interviewed quite a few people that, a core of people that were descendants of those people from southern Spain
mm-hmm.
to the wine islands, like myself and all of us represented today. Tell people a little bit about that work.
Sure. Well, I'm involved in a major archival project where we're trying to put together an archive of documents and photographs that will help historians in the future document the history of Spanish immigrants in the U.S. So we're working on the entire United States, the chapter of Spaniards in Hawaii and California obviously is a really important one. But as you were saying, it's part of a larger process. So at the same time that roughly 8,000 Spaniards were going to Hawaii, you know, the first two decades of the 20th century, let's say, we've got 8,000 Spaniards going to Hawaii, 6,000 to 8,000 Spaniards being recruited to dig the Panama Canal, several thousand Spaniards, also mostly from Andalusia, being taken to Brazil to work on coffee plantations, several thousand Basques being recruited out to the western states to herd sheep, and then in the heavy industry, especially zinc, copper, and steel mills, all over the United States, they actively recruited experienced, semi-skilled Spanish workers by the thousands in the same time frame. So the Hawaiian story is it's huge and it's fascinating. It's kind of the most exotic of the stories because it was the furthest trip and because it involved this second step of the emigration then from Hawaii to California. But it really is part of a much larger story that involved the movement of tens of thousands of Spaniards to the United States. And as all your guests have said, it really is a pretty unknown story that we're trying to piece together, mainly relying on folks like your other guests, people from these communities who love their heritage and who have taken care of it and who have preserved photographs and done oral histories and things like that. Because it's the kind of story that I guess it was Patricia who was saying that, you know, she thought she'd go to the library and take out a book on the Spaniards that went to Hawaii, and if lo and behold there is no book, that book is yet to be written. And she's written a couple of good ones already. But all the work needs to be done, all the groundwork. We need to find the photographs, find the letters, find the pamphlets and the documents, so that we can begin to tell this forgotten story.
Yeah.
I also have a Facebook page, Spanish Immigrants in the United States,
mm-hmm.
Which, like Mike's, which focuses on Hawaiian Spaniards, is a fantastic tool because it's interactive and because it puts information out there, and we're constantly
mm-hmm.
putting stuff out and getting stuff in.
Mm-hmm.
And we can see, just like in Mike's site, you can actually see a community forming around Facebook, which is a fantastic thing to see. People who have been out of touch, we have, you know, cousins rediscovering cousins and people, yeah, all kinds of fantastic connections are happening through the
right.
virtual magic of Facebook.
Right. Well, let me tell you, I mean, not just my guests, myself as well, as you know, my family was from there as well. So this was very important for me to share on this show, you see, because I've already done shows on the Italian Americans. I've done shows on the Sephardic Jew, which was another interesting story. And I felt, you know what, there needs to be a show done on this because it was part of my culture and part of something that a lot of people are not familiar with.
Yeah.
They just don't know about it. I mean, I've had people say to me, your grandparents went where?
Right.
And I said, they went to Hawaii. And they said, so they're from Spain? And they'd look at me as if, you know, this was like some kind of fairy tale.
Right.
And I said, yes, they went to the Hawaiian Islands.
Yeah.
Why? And then I would tell them. And I said, you know, in fact, my grandparents were married there. And then, you know, years later, they immigrated to... 8 years later, they immigrated to San Francisco, and then years later, my mother was born. But, you know, to a lot of people, that they hear of Spanish history, they hear of Spaniards, but it's not something that is real common. Just
yeah.
kind of like the time that I heard the story about two different ones. One, the Spanish immigration to Louisiana. From the Canary Islands. I had never heard that. I had never heard of those Spanish people that immigrated from Asturias and Galicia to West Virginia to work the coal mines, or to Virginia to work the coal. I never had heard of that at all. And so these stories to me were something like that seemed kind of different, you know, because it was
yeah,
not
yeah,
part
yeah.
of my realm. It wasn't part of my history. I had no idea. You know, and I think you and I have talked about this, and you mentioned this too before. You know, I think we get so caught up in what is traditionally Spanish. This is Spanish, that's Spanish. But yet foods can be very different. You know, there are certain things that still remain the same that are, you know, like standard, like your paella and certain things. But there are other regional foods that are very different.
Yeah, definitely. Well, our first, so we go around the country and do field work, right, interviewing and scanning family albums and things like that. And then with that material, we process it and put it online in an archive that we're building. But we also try to process some of that material into documentary films,
mm-hmm.
just to you know, to present it in a kind of nicely packaged and entertaining way. And the first
Absolutely.
Documentary that we made, it's called Dan Albert's Paella, La Paella de Daniel Albert, and it's about the peculiar paella that's prepared by the son of Spanish immigrants who had gone to Hawaii and then re-emigrated to California. Dan Albert, who was the mayor of the city of Monterey, California for 20 years, 1986
uh-huh.
to 2006, is the son of Hawaiian Spaniards. A lot of people don't know that. And he's proud to make his mom's paella, which he kind of half jokingly said was the best paella in California, mm-hmm. and it was pretty good. But for him, authentic paella, his mom's paella, is made with Uncle Ben's rice, because that's, you know, what's authentic. What your mom did is what's authentic, right?
And, that's cool. I mean, I'm not trying to laugh, but really, quite honest. I mean, you know, really. So I guess maybe I'm not going to be sarcastic. I was going to say, well, so then I guess there's Uncle Ben's in Spain too. But
well,
I guess, yeah,
you
I
know,
get
it's
it.
It's a delicious dish in its own
sure.
right, and it's his. That's why we call the film Dan Albert's paella. It's his paella, and it's his version of authenticity.
Right. Right. It makes me laugh because I just picked up a package of rice-a-roni paella. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
it's rice-a-roni paella. Okay, so I made it, and, you know, I was thinking, okay. Yeah, you're good. So I was thinking, okay, this is, and I thought, you know what, it's not yellow enough. It doesn't have any saffron or something's wrong with it, you know. And so anyway, I had some paella coloring, so I added some of that that I got from La Española down in Southern California. And then, you know, I was still looking at it, and it just didn't look the same to me. And when I tasted it, I was like, this is completely wrong. I mean, for me, because it was too smoky. There was a smoky element that wasn't from pimenton either. It was different. It tasted to me, at least the one I had, reminded me of kind of a little bit of jambalaya or dirty rice. And I know jambalaya actually came from, you know, the origins are back to when the Isleños from the Canary Islands went to Louisiana. Many of them brought their paella, and then it was spiced up a little bit, you know. The people in Louisiana spiced it up a little bit, ended up calling it jambalaya. And so jambalaya has its roots in paella, but it tasted more like a jambalaya base than it did.
Right,
Yeah. But, you know, I was talking to somebody, and they tried it, and they said, oh, it's wonderful. It tastes so much like, and I thought, doesn't even.
Yeah.
But you know what? Hey, I've got to try that sometime. I'll try it with Uncle Ben's rice, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So it was a great recipe that he had that you were able to sample. Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
well,
I mean,
in the documentary, we cut back and forth between he prepared the paella for a group of 10 Spanish friends. And we followed him around as he made the purchases of the ingredients in the beautiful outdoor market in Monterrey. And then we intercut the preparation of the paella with him and his wife putting together a photo album. So those two stories, the making of the paella and the telling of his story through photos, is what structures the documentary.
Wow.
And I think it's fun, yeah.
Yeah. I know that you had also talked about, which I think is really important too, the Spanish people that landed in Florida, whether it be in the Miami area or whether it be in the Tampa area, and even though Cuban food is very much related, they cook a lot of the same dishes as Spanish people do, because obviously there were a lot of Spaniards that immigrated to Cuba. But even some of the Spanish food there has kind of slants that lean a little towards Cuban food.
Yeah,
correct.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, Tampa became a major Spanish speaking city after the cigar industry was brought there in 1886. In 1886, Tampa had 700 inhabitants. It was a sleepy fishing village, and by 1920, it had over 100,000 inhabitants and I think 200 cigar factories. And most of the owners of those factories were from Spain, and a lot of the cigar workers were as well. And so in Tampa, a culture emerged, a cuisine and a culture, and even you can hear it even in the Spanish that's spoken there, and it's not Spain Spanish, and it's not Cuban Spanish, it's Tampeño Spanish. It's a really fascinating case of this emigration. There's also
examples
of...
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Okay,
sorry.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
There are some Latin American foods that find their way back into the menus of Spain, since there was a significant amount of back and forth. I mean, basic ingredients the national dish of Spain, some would say, is the Spanish omelet, tortilla de patatas, and there were no potatoes in Spain before the Spaniards arrived to the Andes, where the from where the potato is native. Or gazpacho made with tomatoes. Tomatoes were non-existent in Europe until after Columbus's voyages. So there are ingredients and even some culinary traditions in authentic, quote-unquote, Spanish cuisine that don't exist until after the discovery of the New World.
Right, and some of those additions to even Latin American cooking, even the banana, some of them actually came over from where? The Canary Islands, mm-hmm. which the Canary Islands from Spain over to the Americas. So it's kind of interesting how there's an interchange there. So I wanted to go back to something you were saying about the language, Tampeño. So would you say it's similar to an Andalusian or Canarios type of Spanish?
It's hard to say in that regard. I mean, what we call Cuban Spanish has a lot of similarities with Canary Island Spanish because there was such an important influx of Canarios into Cuba. So it's hard. Like I said, you know, since it's several centuries of back and forth, it's hard to know what comes from where. But yeah, I would say, you know, the Spanish people that we interviewed in Cuba when we spoke to them in Spanish, I probably, out of context, I probably would have thought that they were Cuban just from their accent.
Right, and as you know, the Andalusian accent, many times depending on where you're from, can sound very much like a Latin American. Or Latin
sure.
American sounds very, and can sound very much like Puerto Rican, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I was talking to another, her family immigrated to Hawaii, and then actually they went back from Hawaii to Estepona, where my family's from. And so we were talking in Spanish, and I said, do people ever, when they're hearing you speak Spanish, do they always place you as being from Spain? And she said, no, sometimes they place me as being from Puerto Rico. And I said, see, the same thing with me, you know. Sometimes people are looking at me, you know, they're hearing my Spanish and they're like, well, there's certain things that you say that remind us of, you know, people from Puerto Rico. And it's
right.
because the Caribbean accent, be it Puerto Rican or Cuban, a lot of them got their the way of speaking from the Andalusian. Right? So
yeah.
Tell me about some really interesting projects you got going or coming up, and then I think we're going to wrap it up here.
Oh, we've got so much going on, Joey. We're finishing up a documentary about Tampa. It's going to premiere in Tampa in November, and the working title is A Legacy of Smoke, Spanish Immigrants in Tampa. And that title obviously plays on the importance of cigars and tobacco. But it also points to this kind of paradox that this once vibrant and really large community has very little left to speak of outside the imagination and the kind of private culture of the descendants. So we're hard at work at that. And we're also we're about to launch a project to put together a book of photographs, a kind of deluxe edition of photographs, many of which received, scanned from folks like Mike and Gloria and Patricia and folks all over the country, a book of photographs that will kind of lay out this vast history of the presence of Spaniards in the U.S. in the early 20th century. It's called Invisible Immigrants, Spaniards in the U.S., and then we give it dates that are kind of important to us, 1868 to 1945. Mm-hmm. So that's what's got us busy right now. And the Facebook page where we post four times a day, always a new post at 2 a.m., 8 a.m., 2 p.m., and 8 p.m., and generates a lot of interesting chatter, and we learn a lot from it.
Well, that's wonderful. Sounds like you got a lot of great things going on. I am going to personally be in touch with you rather shortly about a couple of things. But anyway, I thank you so much for joining us. I continue blessings on your work, and I hope to one day be able to meet you and talk to you and maybe share some photos with you from our families as well.
Oh, that'd be
stories,
great. Yeah.
And maybe have you collaborate on something in the very near future with
Excellent.
Us. So thank you, James, for joining us all the way from the East Coast. But stay here with us because we're wrapping the show up here, folks, and you've been listening to really just a great show on the immigration of the Spaniard to the Hawaiian Islands. And you're still with us here, right? You still are there with me. But now what I want to do is, you know, I really believe in paying our respects to those that have gone before us. I think this is just so important, and I hope my system stays up while we do this. But I think it's so very, very, very important to really thank those people that were in our families that really paved the way for us. So what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to have some music playing in the background. It won't necessarily be any Spanish music, but it'll be ambient music, sort of. And then I just want us to really think of those people that did make their way over from Spain to Hawaii. Those that are our grandparents, even our great-grandparents, and just remember them. And perhaps what we can do in remembrance and honor of them is call out their names. And I'm going to go in the order that we started the show. I'm going to start, and hopefully we will not have any interruptions, and then I'm going to have Patricia come on and give the names of her family members, and then I'm going to have Gloria come on, and then Mike, and then Jim, and I will start this. Isabel del Sagrado Corazón de Jesús, Aguilar Hoyos, José Vilches Gil, María Hoyos Jerez, Diego Aguilar Vélez, Francisca Gil Montoya, Bartolomé Vilches Troyano. And now I go to Patricia.
Manuela Silvan Tres Casas, Rita Estepia, Marzo Garcia, Juan Francisco Silvan Hernandez, Bernardo Ruiz Romero, Francisco Ruiz Garcia.
And now I am going to go to Gloria.
Juan Carvajal Carvajal, Maria Muniz Calderon, Juan Muniz Carvajal, Feliciana Aguilera Martin Carvajal, y también Rafael Ramos López y Francisca Filomena Invernán López.
And now I'm going to ask for Mike to come on.
Isabel Calero Corrales, Cayetano Garcia Serrana, Rosalia Torres Campos, or Sanchez, and Jose Alarcón Campos.
Y ahora el último de la noche, and James Fernandez, I would ask that he join us now and tell us the names of his family.
My grandfather was Jose Fernandez Alvarez, and my grandmother was Carmen Alonso Mier. On my father's side, that's the Spanish side.
And now, folks, as we end the show, we do hope that what we shared with you, you can share with others, that it will be enlightening. And again, we want to just remember those people that really started the journey from Spain, our families. And so, on behalf of myself here, live from the Bay with Joey, I want to thank you and thank all those that participated tonight. Patricia Ruiz Steele, Gloria Lopez, Michael Munoz, James Fernandez. I want to thank everyone that participated, and I want to thank you. And I want to thank you for taking this show and sharing it with others so we can keep this alive and this legacy, this story, very much a part of who we are as we continue and our families continue. Until the next time, this is Joey saying take care.
Thank you for joining us today on Live from the Bay with Joey.